loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big issues. First, Donald Trump is off to Asia for nearly 2 weeks, where he will visit five countries. While a range of issues will be discussed, his top priority appears to be beating the drums of war against North Korea. Then, the fallout is continuing from Donna Brazile's claim that Hillary Clinton orchestrated, in her words, a secret takeover of the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, before becoming the party's candidate in the 2016 election. But first, we turn to Donald Trump's trip to Asia. He's off to Asia for nearly 2 weeks, where he will visit five countries. While a range of issues will be discussed, his top priority appears to be beating the drums of war against North Korea. We are joined from Norfolk, Connecticut by Patrick Lawrence. He is the author of Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century. And he's a columnist writing on foreign affairs for The Nation magazine. We're also joined in studio by Walter Smolarek. He is a Sputnik News analyst. Welcome, Patrick and Walter.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
Patrick Lawrence, there's a lot of talk in the media about the fact that Donald Trump has even extended the trip to Asia, already a very long trip, the longest trip by an American president to Asia since, I believe, 1991 or 1992. Talk about the significance of the trip from the point of view of the United States and Asia, and also the difference between now and 25 years ago.
Yeah, okay. I had it wrong in my column, the column that brings us together. I had it as the longest trip an American president has ever made. My error. George H.W. made a slightly longer trip in 1991. What do we want to see in this trip? We're not going to learn anything about Asia or Asians in the course of the next 2 weeks. We're going to learn about ourselves. Asia has this very peculiar characteristic. So often in history, it effectively holds up a mirror to the West, such that we see ourselves. That's this. And I think what we're going to see is the fairly startling deficiencies of American foreign policy across the Pacific. I'm talking specifically not only about Trump's slight knowledge of the region, but also his habit of saying one thing on Tuesday at 10 o'clock and another thing on Tuesday at 2 o'clock and another thing on Wednesday. This leaves the Asians quite confused. And not to be missed, American policy across the Pacific since the onset of the Cold War, I put it at 47, has not essentially been a foreign policy. It's been a security policy. And in this case, the choreography is absolutely fascinating. Prior to Trump's departure, Defense Secretary Mattis went to had discussions with the three most important people on the trip, apart from China. He went to Manila, addressed the Filipinos and also the Japanese there, and then went to Seoul. In my analysis, that's because what needs to get done between Washington and the Asians is going to get done by the Defense Department. Curiously enough, Secretary of State Tillerson follows Trump through the region. I think he goes next week, effectively in Trump's wake. And what you have here is an administrative apparatus in Washington that seems to have said to itself, let him go and eat all the food, and maybe they'll even give him chocolate cake, but we will, one, advance him with what needs to be done substantially, that's Mattis, and two, follow him with Tillerson, who can clean up whatever messes there may be. That's it. It's gesture, this trip, not to say of no consequence.
Along that same line,
the State Department does not have an assistant secretary for East Asian Affairs and has not had one since March 17th when the last assistant secretary resigned. So it seems to me, and please tell me if I'm wrong, that this trip, no matter how long it is, and it is quite long, is really more for show than it is anything else. If there are no assistant secretaries or deputy assistant secretaries in place to conduct negotiations with these countries, nothing really is going to be done substantively, right?
I agree. It's ceremony, as I said. It's gesture. But let us not mislead your listeners into thinking that this is the problem of Donald Trump. I do tire of that. We personalized the problem that arose during the in the post September 11th environment. It's all George Bush's fault. No, and emphatically, it is not Donald Trump's problem. When we look across the Pacific, it's a systemic problem. Asia is evolving at a speed it is hard to convey to people who haven't been there or who are not in some way obliged to watch closely, okay? You're not going to see the velocity of events in Asia from our mainstream press. You can't, right? They don't tell you. But Asia is moving swiftly. As I said in that column, it is not waiting for the future. It is reaching out for it and making it. There's nothing that makes this more evident than Xi Jinping's Belt and Road stuff, right? No question. And the real problem is not Donald Trump. The real problem is we are very flat-footed. As I said in that column, this is yesterday meets tomorrow. And yesterday, by definition, never has anything to say to tomorrow. It doesn't understand.
Walter Smolarek, Patrick Lawrence, in his column in The Nation about this trip, also makes the point that Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, gave a very, as I think Patrick calls it, a very confident speech at the 19th Party Congress. You know, there was that famous quote from Deng Xiaoping, an instruction to his successors to, quote, hide our light and nurture our strength. Xi Jinping was not hiding any light. He was affirming very loudly and clearly that China's intention was to become a major player in the world. Well, it is a major player, but, you know, to reclaim its position in the world. And also by the year 2035 and then another benchmark of 2050 to become really what amounts to be the single most important country in the world. Trump, of course, right before he left for China, condemned the Chinese for creating the opioid crisis in the United States. There's that West Virginia county that's suing the pharmaceutical companies and the CVS and Walgreens because they pumped like 40 million opioid pills into a county of 90,000 people. But nonetheless, I mean, how does that play out for the Chinese leadership, which is asserting itself right now on the eve of the trip for Donald Trump to go at them once again?
Yeah, Donald Trump's policy towards China, as is the case with many, many areas of his foreign policy, is highly contradictory, and it changes from almost day to day. I mean, the economic talks that they're going to be having there in China, I think, is principally for domestic political consumption. You know, they're making a big fuss about technology transfer, which is, you know, of course, an important thing for China's economic development. When a corporation from the West or from anywhere sets up shop in China, they're generally stipulations that they have to show their Chinese partners how to use advanced technology, production techniques, and so forth. And so, you know, I think that we'll see a lot of tweets or statements or whatever he's going to do about technology transfer and trade. You know, there's the investigation that inquiry that the Commerce Department has open about Chinese steel tariffs and steel imports. So I think that he may choose to go for sort of an economic focus to kind of shore up some of his support at home. I do think that Korea, the Korea discussions and what Trump says about Korea in Japan, in South Korea is going to be of pretty significant importance. The United States carried out what North Korea calls a nuclear bombing drill just the other day, where they flew several bombers right up to the nearly up to the border and, you know, practice dropping what could be an atomic weapon. So the tensions are very high there. Abe is trying to get rid of Article 9. So, you know, there's the whole remilitarization thing as well. So I think some of the military discussions will be of consequence.
Yeah, Patrick, talk about that. You said in your article, Trump moves onto Beijing a couple of weeks after Xi Jinping's strikingly confident speech at the Communist Party Congress earlier this month. One is certain the Trump White House heard the Chinese leader's remarks, but nearly as certain the president and his people did not listen to them at all. In all likelihood, Xi will merely have to repeat what he has said countless times already to no evident result. No, we cannot solve the Korea crisis for you. We will do what we can, but that is only so much, and we are dead against another of your American regime changes. Talk about that. I mean, do you feel that the Chinese position is as it has been, or do you? There are some like when I'm reading Global Times, again, not an official Chinese Communist Party source, but something close to their views. There seems to be a greater stridency against the DPRK, which didn't exist in the media, Chinese media, in the past.
I agree with you, but no contradiction, Brian. Let us not forget, the Chinese, the Russians, nobody else wants the North to proceed with tests of missiles or nuclear weapons. There's no question of that. They are happy to sanction the North Koreans. Maybe happy isn't the right word, but they are willing to sanction the North Koreans because they want Pyongyang to calm down. There's no question there. But it is not that does not contradict the assertion that China in no way has moved an inch from its position that this is to be resolved by way of negotiation. And the negotiation that needs to take place is between Pyongyang and Washington, not between Pyongyang and anybody else. That hasn't changed. Your listeners need to parse this a little carefully. Sanctions, more and more sanctions, are not an indication that China or anyone else has altered its position. The South Korean position is exactly the same. Everybody made this mistake a few months ago when President Moon began talking tough with the North and went along with another round of quite stringent sanctions. That's fine. But Moon's view is perfectly plain if you look closely. He is for... He stands with Beijing for effectively a revival of the six-party talks that actually went some distance before they either failed of their own or were sabotaged, depending on how you look at it. And those talks are between the North is on one side of the table, China, South Korea, Japan, Russia, and the United States are on the other. That's what China favors, and Moon is with him on that. That's quite clear now. They've just made up over the anti-missile defense system.
You point that out in your article in The Nation, and it seems that it's the United States that's going to be left in the cold when really the policy that we see exhibited by all these Asian capitals has not changed. It's the U.S. approach to that policy that's changed.
The U.S. has been in the cold, John, for quite some while. we are just not informed sufficiently, ordinary American readers and viewers, and thinking people altogether, are not sufficiently informed to understand this. We're the odd man out here. We're not holding the torch of anything for the rest of the world. We are not cajoling. We are being cajoled. I mean, the bottom line of the Trump trip to through Asia, I'm not quite sure I agree with Walter on this point. I really don't see it being of any great consequence because he's not going to get anything done so long as he continues demanding things that are never going to come in Washington's way. That's it. It's an expression of bankruptcy, and that's the word I have for American policy across the Pacific altogether.
We're speaking with Patrick Lawrence. He is an author. He's also a columnist with The Nation. You can read his most recent article, Trump Goes to Asia, but the Pentagon Gets There First. Subtitled, Mattis Confirms Policy with Manila, Tokyo, and Seoul Before the President's First Trip Across the Pacific. Patrick Lawrence, Donald Trump likes Rodrigo Duterte. He likes his style. Now, Duterte, when he first came in, was making a lot of talk about a new day for the Philippines, not going to be anybody's puppet, not going to carry anybody else's water. He went to China and said, you know, they want to have good relations with China, better relations. They don't want to have the dispute in the South China Seas over islands break into the open. And he at the same time said he wanted negotiations with the New People's Army, the National Democratic Front, in other words, to end the armed struggle that began in 68. Now he's kind of singing a different tune. He seems more pro-U.S. He's getting, of course, bad coverage, as one would think, in the U.S. media about the terrible assassination campaign against people involved, even low-level people involved in the drug trade or people who are drug addicts. But talk about Trump and Duterte and the U.S. and the Philippines in this new piece.
Sure. I'm not sure, Brian, you and I heard the same song when we heard Duterte start singing a tune, as you say. I don't think for Duterte or anybody else in Southeast Asia, the name of the game is no longer Washington, altogether Beijing. It's not that. Cast your mind back to the non-aligned movement, okay? It's roughly the same principle. Nobody sees any need to push Washington into the past. Washington will do that on its own if it insists. It's not a question of a choice. It's a question of opening to new alternatives and accommodating the realities, exploiting the opportunities that emergent China presents. That's what Duterte has been saying all along. The trip to Beijing, I think it was last spring, was quite a remarkable gesture, no issue. But I don't think he was ever saying, finished with the Americans. He may have made some dramatic statements to that effect. I don't think it was ever fated to be substantive at the policy level. As far as Trump and Duterte are concerned, I think there's a question of style here. Duterte is a plain speaker. As I said in the column, he assumes that everything in the universe is perfectly simple and anybody can understand it on a seat of the pants basis. This is Donald Trump stuff, right? So they're consonant in that respect. But Duterte harbors a very deep resentment toward the United States as he looks out at his country after decades and decades of 70 years of effectively American patronage in an essentially neo-colonial relationship. He looks out and says, look at this place. What used to be called the Pearl of the Orient, and I kid you not, it was once, is now an absolute disgrace. I'm called to task on occasion for not being more vigorously critical of Duterte and his war on drugs, okay? It is not a nice thing to watch, okay? There are many things that one cannot in any way condone. However, I am quite sympathetic to Duterte's pride as a Filipino, his resentment as to why this came to be, his insight into American culpability to some extent we can't measure right now, but significant culpability for what he sees when he looks out the window at Malacañang Palace, right? He looks out at an unbelievably disorderly, poverty-ridden city and indeed country. I understand that. I sympathize with that. I think we all should. And his war on drugs, he is essentially saying, I want to clean this country up. Beyond that method, well, yes, problems. There's a lot to criticize. I won't be at all ambiguous about that. But that's how I see Duterte, right? You have to, I mean, my favorite dismissal of Duterte belongs to Max Boot of the Council on Foreign Relations, a piece of wisdom every time he puts his pen to paper. After Duterte's visit to Beijing and his vigorous criticisms of the U.S.-Filipino relationship, Boot wrote, he's a psychologically disturbed person. There's nothing more to it. This is why we don't understand what's going on the other side of the Pacific Ocean.
John Kiriakou, that's a very interesting point. I mean, and Duterte was the mayor of Davao and Mindanao, and I predominantly, not maybe predominantly, but a large Muslim population. Also, the part of the Philippines that took the brunt of the U.S. invasion in 1898 and 1899, where a million Filipinos died.
And that's something that Americans don't know. It's not taught here, but you're right. A million Filipinos died.
Yeah, a million people died. And that's where the U.S. really created what became known as the modern surveillance state, the way U.S. military, and it migrated back to the United States and was used for all kinds of things.
When Duterte started laying into Washington for the nature of the relationship with the between the Philippines and the U.S., there was a famous photograph taken of, well, a widely circulated photograph of him taken while he was declaiming and railing. Okay, we saw that picture in the paper. We didn't see one part of this picture. He was holding up a photograph. The photograph was of a mass grave of Filipino soldiers dug by Americans around 1900 or 1901 after a very famously savage battle of the Aguinaldo people against the invading American forces. That was, I mean, where is Stalin when we really need him? That was airbrushed out of the photograph. I think it was an AFP photograph. It was in the photograph when it was published in Europe and elsewhere. That's what, yeah, that I thought that might be an interesting detail for your listeners to consider.
Walter and Patrick, we have 5 minutes left. In advance of the Trump visit to Asia, as Patrick has said, Mattis went first. But it wasn't just Mattis. There was also three aircraft carriers and battle groups that have been sent and dispatched to that part of the world. We were all talking here in the studio, and John Kiriakou said a couple of weeks ago, hey, we have to get really alarmed if the U.S. starts sending a bunch of aircraft carriers and battle groups to the Pacific towards Korea. And indeed, they have. Question for Walter and then for Patrick. Is the United States planning to attack North Korea?
I think it's possible. I don't think that they're imminently planning anything right now, but they're clearly getting prepared and they want to have the option to do that. There's certainly a sizable section of policymaking and military elites in the U.S. that think that, you know, well, okay, eventually we're going to have to go to war with Korea. There's no way that there could be negotiation. As Trump says on Twitter all the time, you know, the negotiations are a waste of time. We're never going to get anywhere. And ultimately, there has to be a military strike of some type, whether or not that means, you know, like a full-on destruction of the North or just what they refer to as a decapitation strike where they try to kill the North Korean leadership. And so we might as well do it sooner rather than later when they have a more advanced nuclear deterrent. So, you know, they have, like you said, the three aircraft carriers. You know, of course, there's about 30,000 U.S. troops in South Korea, and I believe about 50 or so thousand U.S. troops in Japan. I mean, they have lots and lots of military assets in the area. There's the Air Force Base in Guam that they've been moving, you know, more strategic airplanes and weapons to. So they're clearly setting themselves up for a situation where if they choose to, if there's some sort of crisis, you know, like if, you know, the North Korea makes a breakthrough in terms of missile technology or does another nuclear test, you know, they'll have the ability to if they want to.
Patrick Lawrence, same question to you.
I'm generally with Walter. Mattis came out, no, not Mattis, McMaster, came out a few weeks ago and said negotiation with North Korea would represent a failed policy. It will only lead to a dead end as it always has in the past. So there is a considerable constituency for this. I view the buildup as still probably in the realm of display, okay? I don't like cliches, but I suppose saber rattling will do, right? I don't think intent is yet in place. There is also, I just read something, I forget who put it out, the Arms Controls Association or somebody like that in Washington. There is also a sizable and growing constituency for they wouldn't put it this way, but caving in and negotiating, okay? The Trump administration is back-channeling through what they call the UN channel, meaning Trump has a diplomat operating out of Washington, but often here in New York, talking with the North Korean mission, okay? That is going on. We don't know much about the substance, but there are contacts. So it's a very, very ambiguous situation at the moment. In sum, what I would say is that the United States is certainly exceedingly nervous about what is going on now. I think that's one reason why it can't come to a decision. But the situation as we approach crisis with this, if we're not in one already, let's all bear in mind, this is the consequence of many, many years of the Americans either refusing to negotiate at all or sabotaging negotiations by way of its insincerity all through the process. Nobody really looked ahead, as Washington rarely does, back in the 70s and 80s when we attempted negotiations with the North, and it was just beginning to develop a nuclear program with Russian assistance. Now, it wasn't really anything of very great magnitude, okay? Why, you know, everything went along as it had through the 50s and 60s and most of the 70s. Just leave it, right? Now we come out the other end and all that nonsense and foot shuffling, now they do have nuclear capability and we just waited around for them to develop it.
That's the consequence, I guess, of strategic patience, so-called. Anyway, we've been joined from Norfolk, Connecticut, by Patrick Lawrence. He is the author of Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century. He's also a columnist at The Nation. You can read his works at thenation.com. He's a foreign affairs analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a very short break, we will be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening
to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The fallout is continuing from Donna Brazile's claim that Hillary Clinton orchestrated, in her words, a secret takeover of the DNC before becoming the party's candidate in the 2016 election. We're joined from Washington by Max Blumenthal. He's a journalist and best-selling author whose latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. He's also the senior editor of Alternate's Gray Zone Projects. Max, thanks for coming back. We're always happy to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
This story seems to be taking on a life of its own in Washington. Donna Brazile, I find this to be fascinating that Donna Brazile has written this book that appears, at least at first glance, to be a tell-all, and she's sort of presenting herself as this honest broker. She's come out to tell the truth about the Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee, the state of the DNC, just before the election. In fact, she's not really an honest broker, is she? I wonder why she has decided to come out now and why she's decided to criticize the Clinton campaign with some very disturbing accusations.
Well, Donna Brazile's been sort of part of the problem, not just in 2016, but she's just a key cog in the Democratic Party's corporate machine. And she did a terrible job as interim director of the DNC. Fundraising was at an almost all-time low under her watch. And we also know that she fed debate questions to Hillary Clinton and declared publicly, I'm with her. She was fully in the Clinton camp. So in a lot of ways, she's saving her own skin here. She's covering her back. But what she's also doing by this revelation, this stunning revelation of the joint fundraising agreement that put the Clinton campaign fully in charge of the entire Democratic National Committee apparatus, is she's aligning herself with the future of the party, which is Bernie Sanders and, to a certain extent, Elizabeth Warren. And this is just one of many autopsies that are coming out about the Democratic Party, while Clinton people are still trying to deflect with Russiagate. So I think it's still significant, regardless of Donna Brazile's background.
You know, she makes an accusation here related to the state Democratic parties and fundraising within the states, and it's something like 32 or 34 states. What she describes is essentially a money laundering operation where money is supposed to be raised. It was supposed to be split between the state parties and the DNC. In fact, something like 95 or 98% of the money ended up going to the Clinton campaign in the form of the two Clinton super PACs. How is that legal? And how is that good for the Democratic Party?
Well, Donna Brazile said that what she uncovered was not illegal, although she wasn't entirely sure if it was legal or not. And she just had to conclude that it was unethical. So even operating at the level she was at, that this was unethical, also must lead us into a critique that the Clinton campaign had committed malpractice. What they were doing by hoarding all of this money through these massive fundraisers with the corporate base, with their corporate patrons, was two things. Number one, prioritizing the corporate donors over actual voters and the Democratic Party's base that they've abused for so many years. And number two, they're basically paying all their buddies off through these super PACs. There was more money than they knew what to do with, and they were creating all of these bogus initiatives, like Peter Dow's $1 million plan to actually pay trolls to go on Twitter and attack Bernie Sanders supporters, which is what their, you know, Congress is holding hearings on about Russia. This is an actual initiative of a Clinton super PAC overseen by this hack who is a former disco keyboardist named Peter Dow for $1 million out of this money to pay for trolls to attack quote unquote Bernie bros on Twitter. So this is the ridiculous shenanigans the Clinton campaign was in, while Donna Brazile revealed that less than 1% of the money from these Clinton mega fundraisers went to state politics. You know, the 50-state plan Howard Dean said that he wanted to put in place was just a joke. And that cost the Clintons, that cost Hillary in the end when she couldn't pick up Wisconsin or Michigan. That's why she lost in these states.
The Donna Brazile revelations, John, show that the Clinton campaign was working with the DNC behind the scenes with this kind of arrangement since before the primary season even started.
Oh, yes.
I mean, it was back in 2015.
That's right. They laid the groundwork for this as soon as Debbie Wasserman Schultz became chairman of the DNC.
So then you have Hillary Clinton secretly working with and really controlling the DNC, and thus the DNC funding, the DNC strategy, the DNC priorities. In the run-up to the primary season where Democratic voters thought, and millions of people registered for Democrat as Democrats because they wanted to participate, especially those for the first time, because they thought they were going to have the say-so, the final say on who the Democratic Party nominee would be. But it turns out that behind the scenes, the Sanders allegations and the allegations coming from the Sanders camp that it was rigged, not only might be true, it's completely true. I mean,
completely true. And you remember back then, Brian and Max, the complaints were largely about the superdelegates and how the deck was stacked against Bernie Sanders because there were all of these party officials from around the country that were counted as superdelegates and had pledged themselves to Hillary Clinton. Well, as it turns out, it wasn't just the superdelegates. The fix was in relative to the money as well. And now in retrospect, it appears that not only did Bernie Sanders not have a chance, but it was miraculous that he came as close as he did to winning this nomination.
Right. I mean, if you go back to Nevada and you remember the tussle at the Nevada Democratic Caucus and all of the national press mocking the Bernie delegates, mocking Bernie caucus goers and claiming they were throwing chairs. Now it all seems pretty clear that they knew that the fix was in. They knew it was rigged and they were right. The national press was completely wrong. And Nevada and Bernie Sanders may have actually won Nevada. There was no recount. And beyond that, he certainly would have if the DNC hadn't interfered in favor of Hillary Clinton. We also have emails from some of the figures that were put into place through the Clinton campaign and the DNC, like Brad Marshall, who proposed attacking Bernie Sanders for his Jewish religion and his atheism so that Hillary Clinton could pick up southern states. I mean, there was a smear campaign orchestrated at the highest levels of the DNC, thanks to the joint fundraising agreement. As you pointed out, this agreement was put in place in 2015, before the campaign even began in earnest, because Debbie Wasserman Schultz had run the DNC into the ground, along with Obama, who had put it as something like $8 million in debt. So Hillary Clinton comes in with all of her big corporate donors, and they pledged to bail it out of the debt in order for this, you know, Faustian bargain, this secret agreement that puts them in power at every level. And it wasn't a miracle that Bernie Sanders managed to get as far as he did. It spoke to the real yearning of the Democratic Party's base, of the coalition that has been abandoned year after year by the Democratic Party for a real populist economic message that was based on class. And the Clinton campaign went ahead and abandoned that message in the general election. We need to really focus in on what Tony Fabrizio, who was the pollster for the Trump campaign, said 5 days ago at Harvard in no uncertain terms: Bernie Sanders would have won a general election. And so this had real consequences. We're not just talking about the Democratic primary. We're talking about putting Trump in the White House because of this secret bargain between the Clinton campaign and the DNC.
Brian Becker, how much does this sound like what Richard Nixon did to the Democrats in 1972? They identified the weakest possible candidate and said, we want to run against him. And the next thing you know, Ed Muskie is discredited, Hubert Humphrey is out of the race, and George McGovern gets the nomination. This is exactly the opposite, where the Democrats say, who's the strongest possible candidate? Let's make sure he doesn't win so we can give this nomination to Hillary Clinton.
But there's another side to it, too, which is that the Democrats also had their favorite choice. I mean, Bill Clinton was conferring with Donald Trump, a friendly conference, talking to him, encouraging him to run. And we know now that the Democrats, in all of their wisdom, in all of their sagacity, decided that if only they could get Donald Trump to be the person they were running against, it would be in the bag. I mean,
because he couldn't possibly win a national election.
Couldn't possibly win. So actually, they got what they wanted and still couldn't win because Hillary Clinton running against undoubtedly the most unpopular and the most retrograde political candidate, at least in the last 100 years,
right,
still couldn't win.
Yeah, this was actually a strategy that was put into writing. We know about it because the DNC emails have been public, and it was called the Pied Piper strategy. The DNC aimed, under the watch of the Clinton campaign, to elevate the Pied Piper candidates who they thought would be easiest to beat by refusing to attack them during the Republican primary, and even embracing a strategy that amplified their message. And at the top of the list of Pied Piper candidates was Donald Trump. So you had not only an attempt to wreck the candidate whose message resonated the most, not only with the Democratic Party's base, but with independent voters, who is currently the most popular politician in America, Bernie Sanders, but also a parallel strategy to elevate Donald Trump and secure the nomination for him, which really shows you how delusional and how out of touch the Clinton campaign was, and how much they had internalized the conventional wisdom about everything all the way down to Election Day, which cost them the election. And of course, we know 5 minutes after they lost, they went into a conference room with Robbie Mook and decided to embrace a strategy that blamed Russia.
One of the things about this story is that Donna Brazile's revelations, which I think are pretty much of a bombshell, whatever her motivation is, I mean, they're confirming and they're affirming of the main charge made by the Sanders campaign. And it shows the absolute internal corruption and violation of Democratic Party rules by the Democratic Party leadership and the Clinton campaign working together. And yet it's not really that big of a story, at least on TV news. I mean, Donald Trump, who we of course loathe, is making the point, well, where's MSNBC's coverage on this? And where's CNN's coverage on this? Elizabeth Warren tweeted back after Trump was complaining that the Donna Brazile story didn't get enough credit, enough coverage. She wrote, "I understand your desperation to change the subject at Real Donald Trump. Your campaign manager was just indicted for conspiracy against the U.S. Okay, we're against Donald Trump. I certainly am organizing against Trump. But nonetheless, I mean, it's a pretty small response from this kind of corporate-owned mainstream media. And Elizabeth Warren's tweet is, you're trying to change the story by insisting that it should get bigger coverage and saying that his former campaign manager was indicted for conspiracy against the U.S., which implies that it's a conspiracy like espionage,
right,
when really the conspiracy is tax evasion,
right,
something business people do all the time. Go ahead, Max.
Well, Elizabeth Warren also said that the fix was in and agreed that the campaign was rigged. So she's accusing Trump of doing sort of exactly what she did. And now she's trying to kind of de-link herself from Donald Trump. I really don't know what her strategy is there. But if you step away from this for a second and really take a look at official Washington, and you can imagine, you know, what people in Brussels or Beijing are thinking when they look at this mess. And they look at Manafort's indictment, that he spent $1 million on clothes, that he was involved with literal mobsters, that Washington has, you know, spent a week debating about, you know, Russian troll accounts that were selling LGBT-themed buff Bernie bro coloring books on Facebook, that, you know, Congress is calling for YouTube to shut down RT, that the Podesta group has basically had to shutter because Tony Podesta, the brother of Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, also had the same account as Paul Manafort and may be indicted by Robert Mueller. You know, you step back and look at all of this, and you look at the DNC being completely fixed while the U.S. lectures the world about liberal democracy and its values. You really have to see this as kind of Sodom and Gomorrah. It's just an absolute disaster, and it goes well beyond Trump and Paul Manafort, and it goes to the whole heart of the system, all the way to George H.W. Bush being kind of accused of sexual harassment at the end of his life, and even having to admit that he groped women and called himself David Copperfield. I mean, this is really where our political culture is at, and I've never seen it at a lower point.
I have to ask you also, Max, about Tom Perez, the current chairman of the Democratic National Committee. Perez was Hillary Clinton's candidate. She was the one he was the one who she wanted to take over. He had run for DNC chair against Keith Ellison and a handful of other people, Ellison being preferred by the Bernie camp. Why should we expect anything to change with Hillary Clinton's guy in charge of the party for the next 4 years?
I mean, we shouldn't. And you know, there's a reason why they had to keep Keith Ellison around, which is just to prevent a complete exodus of the party base after coming out in the 11th hour and stabbing Keith Ellison in the back. And Perez was really Obama's guy. I mean, we have to look at Obama also here as a malignant force within the Democratic Party.
Right.
Who's created an Obama Foundation, which looks a lot like the Clinton Foundation. Its board of directors basically comes from Uber and all of the, you know, corporate and hedge fund companies. He has spent his post-presidency on an extended luxury vacation with Richard Branson, doing $400,000 a pop lectures for, you know, venture capital firms. And he put Perez in there to make sure that the party donors would stay in place. And this is just, you know, from a strategic point of view, if you're a Democrat, you have to look at this as a disaster. And you can just look at what happened in Virginia, where the party shunted Tom Perriello, the progressive candidate, aside and put in a nominated Ralph Northam, who is a former military guy who did ads of himself assembling a weapon, who had voted twice for George W. Bush, who is a conservative Democrat, and now he is likely to go down in defeat. He's echoing his opponent's anti-immigrant message. Black politicians in Virginia are warning of low voter turnout, no enthusiasm for this centrist, corporate, charisma-challenged character. And it's just a classic Democratic failure all over again. We saw it in Georgia with John Ossoff. So it goes to the heart of the Democratic Party. And Tom Perez is just, I mean, we're not even going to be talking about this guy in a year or two. Everyone's going to forget he existed. He's such a non-entity. So you're right. We see no attempt to change the structure of the party.
Yeah, and I think it's important that people start to come to grips with the fact that the problem with the Democratic Party is the Democratic Party, and that it's a foundational problem. It's not just the repetition of mistakes over and over again, or the failure to learn lessons. You know, Max, as you're describing this sort of unraveling of the American political establishment, not just the Democrats, the Republicans too, and not just the political parties, the actual functional parts of the government, at least those that, except for perhaps the instruments of repression, and the world looks out at the United States. It was one thing at the end of World War II when the United States had 6% of the world's population and had 50% of the world's production. That kind of like failed policies, mistakes, didn't knock the United States off the pedestal because it had so much economic and military power. The world is a different place now. There's multipolarity. There's economic growth in other places. There's a lot of countries that are sort of bridling at the attempt by the United States to impose its will on them. And at the same time, you have in the United States, through the Bernie Sanders campaign, something very new that started to happen, which was a grassroots, youth-led mass movement. And that's what the Sanders campaign really seemed to represent. I mean, I was in New York. They were getting tens of thousands of people in every borough the 4 or 5 nights before the primary. Most of those young people might not have been able to vote because you had to register 160 days in advance of the Democratic primary in New York to qualify. But it does seem to me that with the old political establishment just showing itself to be useless in a way, it invites a new mass movement that has a new kind of leadership. What do you think about that, Max?
Well, there's a reason why Bernie Sanders is still active in politics, and they're talking about his front runner in 2020, because there's no other candidate who actually commands a movement whose message actually resonates. You know, there's a really interesting essay or sort of autopsy of the Clinton campaign by Stan Greenberg, who is a longtime Clinton pollster, big corporate party hack in the American Prospect, which is a magazine kind of that was spun out of the Clinton campaigns in the 90s, accusing Hillary Clinton of malpractice in her campaign. And what she failed to get, according to Greenberg, is how deep the economic desperation in the country was, how working people had just been systematically abused for decades, but especially by the Obama economy, and how Hillary Clinton refused to speak to their pain with a critique of corporate power and a critique of how class functioned and inequality functioned in the U.S. And that's where Bernie fit in. I didn't think it was even sharp enough of a critique. And there was very little critique of American empire or foreign policy, but it spoke to people. He basically put a grenade in the wall and blew open a hole for all of these debt-saddled young people to run through. And I think that in 2020, the critique has to be much sharper for anyone to be able to challenge a Republican Party that somehow captured the white working class. That's just been, it's not just the white working class, it's also people of color across the country who've just been completely abused, and Democrats have not even made much of an attempt to challenge voter suppression. We saw in the autopsy that's been published by Norman Solomon and a group of progressives in California, Bill Greider, The Nation recently reported on this, that Albert Morales, who was in charge of Latino outreach at the DNC, asked for $3 million to help fight voter suppression in places like New Mexico. And the Democratic Party gave him $300,000. So basically nothing happened. So we've seen across the board just basically the abuse and negligence of all these different groups. And Bernie Sanders, with what I considered a mild message, managed to stir up so much enthusiasm. I think if you actually look back, knowing what we know now, it's pretty clear that Bernie Sanders swallowed a bitter pill that he should not have swallowed at the end of the primary campaign, and he should have kept going.
Yeah, I hear you on that. And I want to go back, John, to something that Max was talking about, which is the issue of empire, because Sanders downplayed that issue too. As a matter of fact, in many ways, adopted what would be a liberal imperial foreign policy.
Yes.
In other words, you can fight for jobs and getting rid of student debt, but don't challenge the empire on the big issues of war and peace or colonization or Israel in a fundamental way. You and I were talking a little bit ago that even though Donald Trump's approval rating is 33%, if he actually went to war, a larger war, say against the DPRK, which both the Democrats and the Republicans are demonizing, or a war somewhere else, in other words, if he sort of rallied the troops around the flag, the political troops, Donald Trump might actually just be able to win to 2020 because, again, with the Democrats, there's almost no distinction between those kind of policies.
Yeah, I say this at every opportunity, to tell you the truth, that on issues of war and peace, there really aren't very many differences between the two parties as parties. You can tinker around the edges, but, you know, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, John Kerry, and Democrats before them, they never saw a war that they didn't want to jump into with both feet. And Bernie Sanders, I think in his heart, is probably different, but I agree with you, Brian, that he's not willing to take that issue on. He's more focused on day-to-day issues of economic injustice and racial equality and things like that. But this is a problem for the Democratic Party. They don't distinguish themselves from the Republican Party and give the American people a real choice, a true choice. I mentioned to you off the air, my son was at a 3-day offsite as part of his school. He's in seventh grade. He went to an island in the Chesapeake Bay called Tangier Island. And he called me from there and he said, "Dad, I've never been in a place like this before. Everybody's white and they all have Trump 2020 signs up in their yards." He said, "I didn't even know Trump was running in 2020. But we have to remember that's America. And that's what we have to work against.
Max Blumenthal, go ahead.
I think Donald Trump could win re-election on the strength of his base against a weak Democrat who has no base or movement behind them. Trump's base voted for a culture war, and that's what he gave them. They didn't want political changes because they've seen no political changes for decades. They've seen no policies that have changed their life in any meaningful way, except with the offshoring of jobs. So they wanted a culture war to annoy coastal elites, and they got it. And they'll vote to continue that. And the Democrats also have to keep that in mind. And it's been incredibly dismaying to see so many Democrats line up, not only behind Trump policies on North Korea and elsewhere, at least not put up a firewall, but also the kind of merger we've seen of the Democratic Party and the intelligence agencies. I mean, we can go back to the Church Commission or to William Fulbright's war against the national security state during the Cold War. And these figures are turning in their grave when they watch Democrats just uncritically cite the DNI report on Russian meddling as if it's the Bible. We've seen sort of nothing from the Democrats to distinguish themselves from the Republicans on foreign policy. And that can also open up the door for a figure like Nikki Haley to emerge in the Republican Party as a viable replacement for Trump. And this is someone who, as U.S. ambassador to the UN, is essentially renting the vacant space in her head to the neocons and the Heritage Foundation, and is pushing the hardest line on Iran and on North Korea. I remember after Trump bombed Syria over the dubious allegations of a chemical attack in Khan Sheikhoun, Nikki Haley emerged on CNN as this kind of hero of the administration. I mean, she was treated as, you know, someone who everyone could rally around with bipartisan fervor. And so they've opened up the door for figures like her. And there's also been very little critique of Mike Pence, who could also be a viable replacement for Trump, who's actually more radical than Trump in many ways and is essentially an American theocrat.
Indeed. Pence is a true believer. He's a real ideologue. And I think probably in the long run, policy-wise, he's more dangerous than Donald Trump.
And the other thing that Max said, which I think is so true, the day after Bernie Sanders' forces were vanquished at the Democratic National Convention, that convention sounded, just to me at least, like the Ronald Reagan Republican conventions in the 1980s. USA, 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 military figures. I mean, they're trying to, quote, steal the thunder of the right. They're trying to pretend to be the right, and thus they are the right.
Right.
And that's not attractive. That's not appealing.
Remember the 2004 convention, John Kerry reporting for duty. They decided to highlight John Kerry's military service, where he jumped off a Swift boat and chased a 15-year-old Viet Cong soldier onto the shore and killed him at point blank range. And that, you know, kind of opened up the door for the Republicans to Swift boat John Kerry. You're not going to out military the Republicans, but that's what the Democrats consistently try to do. They just say that they're going to have, you know, like a rainbow military with, like, you know, rainbow flags on drones in Pakistan's tribal regions. And that's really where they differentiate themselves.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined from Washington, D.C. by Max Blumenthal. He is a journalist, best-selling author, whose latest book is The 51-Day War, Ruin and Resistance in Gaza. He is also the senior editor of Alternet's Gray Zone Project. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.